Downloads of the show are available at Podomatic.com or the Podomatic mobile app. Hey kids, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and this show is Fish Out of Agua with Michelle Carlo. Today is Tuesday, November 14th, 2017, and it seems like we here in beautiful Brooklyn, New York City have skipped straight from summer redux to winter, like overnight. Seriously, it was so cold this past weekend that the gingko tree on my block just dropped all its leaves overnight. All, just released them. And they were still green. I guess when you're done, but as for us, we just getting started here. So keep listening. The crew on the fattest hip-hop record. He touched the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents the fatter joints called undergrounds. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, Boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why's it so fly? Cause hip-hop kept some drama. When butterfly rocked the light new suede boomers. What about a cut? We push it off the corner. How was the buzz entire hip-hop era? Was fresh in fact since they started saying Audi. Cause funk's made fat from right beneath my hood. The pooba of the styles like Miles and shit. Like 60s funky worms with waves and perms. Just sending junky rhythms right down your block. We beat to rap, what key beat to lock. But I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that, I'm cool, I'm cool.
We beat the chocolate stats in my raps. She innovates apple sweeter cat naps. At the funk club with the vibrate. Then they be crazy down with the 5 minute. It can kick a plan, then a crowd burst. Me, I be digging it with the bug burst. Us, we be freaking till dawn, peace and I. He gets a stranger smile, so I say hi. Who understood? Yeah, understood the plans. Him heard of it and put it to his hands. What I just flip, let borders get loose. How to consume all the beaches like juice. If it's the shit, we'll lift it off the plastic. The babes will go spastic. Hip hop games a classic. Shop. It don't matter, I'm fatter, ask butter how I zone.
Man, Cleopatra Jones.
And I'm chill like that, I'm chill like that. I'm chill like that, I'm chill like that. I'm chill like that, I'm chill like that. I'm chill like that, I'm chill.
I got crew kids, 7 and a crescent. Us cause a buzz when a nickel bets a dope. Him, that's my man with the asteroid belt. They catch a fizz from the Mr. Doodle Big. He rocks a tee from the Crooklyn Nine Pigs. The rebirth is slick like my gangster stroll. The lyrics just like Luke coming stacks and rolls. You used to find the bug in a box with Babe. Now he boogies up your stage, plaits twist the braids. And I'm peace like that, I'm peace like that. I'm peace like that, I'm peace like that. I'm peace like that, I'm peace like that.
Just get out, man. I groove like that. I'm smooth like that. I jive like that. I roll like that.
Yeah, I'm thick like that. I stack like that. I'm down like that. I'm black like that.
Yo, I funk like that. I'm fat like that. I'm in like that because I swing like that.
We jazz like that. We freak like that. We zoom like that. We out. We out. We out.
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was the Diggable Planets with Rebirth of Slick, parenthesis, I'm cool like that, from their Reaching, a Refutation of Time and Space album from 1993. And speaking of cool like that,
I can't wait for you to meet our guest artist this week. They are this New Yorkian married theater couple who are passing down that legacy to the next generation and Brooklyn natives. And oh my God, like, they're my favorite people in the whole world. Yeah, I know. Everybody's my favorite. So let's get this fiesta started with this song chosen by this week's guest artist to open their episode.
Summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night, it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity? The days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer. In the city, cool town, meeting in the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop. But at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Just like the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city.
We're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That song was from a 60s band called The Lovin' Spoonful. The song is called Summer in the City, and it's from their Hums of the Lovin' Spoonful album back in 1966, which was also the year that that song was a single. And I think it was like one of, remember I was playing my summer songs from my well-spent youth earlier this year. Well, well-spent youth, 1966. Let's see. Well, I can tell you this. One of the three of us actually was born in 1966. You're just going to have to guess which one. And now, it's time for our favorite part of the show. Welcome to Fish Out of Agua's guest artist of the week. Woohoo! This is my favorite part of the show. I mean, every week I say whoever I'm interviewing is my favorite, but this time it's really true because I'm sitting here with two people, a couple whom I've known doing theater and other things. Oh God, since the beginning, the
21st century.
Oh yeah, beginning of the 21st, right? Not the 20th. Thank you. So this is our first. Double interview. So please welcome to Fish Out of Agua, Allison Astor Vargas and Dennis Vargas.
Hey, woo!
Yay! Oh my God, I've been trying to get you guys together all summer, and I'm just so thrilled. And so how many years of art do we have all together between us?
Oh. Jeez.
Lots.
Between the three of us, we've performed in theaters too numerous and sometimes too torturous to mention.
Too cave-like to mention.
But I'm going to start with you first, Allison. We met through a fellow playwright friend named Franco Ambrís.
Right.
I think right around the turn of the century. We started working together, but what I don't remember was, were you an actress first? Were you always a director? Because I only knew you as a director.
Right. In college I was in plays, but then I decided I'd rather direct. I think I went on an audition, and it was like for some children's show. It was like the part of a talking clock or something like that.
A talking clock?
Yeah, and the people who were auditing weren't really paying attention. I said, this sucks. I'm not doing this. You know, I don't want to torture myself this way. And I prefer directing, actually.
It's like a classic actor. I don't want to act. I want to direct. You guys met in college, correct?
Yes.
And you guys were doing theater in college?
Yes. We were theater majors at Fordham University, the college at Lincoln Center.
You know, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you became a director. And what were we working on together at first?
I think it was an early version of My Red Bush.
And other stories.
Yes. The first time, I think, was PSNBC at Here.
I remember that. That was a showcase that with, I can't remember the name of the person that ran it, but it was a stepping stone to, like, some people would do this showcase, and then they would get to go to the Aspen Comedy Festival, which was a big deal at that time.
Right.
The HBO Aspen Comedy Festival. They don't do that anymore.
No, and it's just such a nice space.
Yeah,
to
the
work
Here space
in.
Is great.
Here is nice.
And PSNBC was a very well-run festival.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing like it today.
Yeah, a lot of programs like that have fallen to the wayside over the years. Mm. But I think that was the first thing we did, and you worked on it, you developed it, and then we did it later on in 2001.
Yes. And that was the production that was truncated because 9/11 happened 2 days before we opened.
Yes.
That's
and
right.
And then we all had a lot worse things to think about than my play is not opening.
And who was in the mindset
Nobody.
To be creative at
no.
that particular
no.
moment?
No.
Also, like a primary day. So I went to go vote, and I took my picture, and I was late. And because I was late, I was on the subway at, 8:30, 8:43, and they said it. A plane just ran into the building, and somebody asked, is the R train still running? And I just thought, I can get through. I think we made it two or three stops, and the train was eerily empty, and the person at Atlantic Avenue said, just go home.
It impacted all theater on the Lower East Side and the East Village for months to come.
Yep.
Because I remember doing another play after, and we were rehearsing it at El Bohio Charas.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was in at the end of October, and you could just, like, every once in a while you would just get this smell coming in the open windows. Like, you know how, like, October's hot in New York sometimes?
Yeah, yeah.
And, no air conditioning.
That was
cool.
Also, I belong to, I was studying at Ensemble Studio Theater, and people, playwrights were going, you know what, I had this comedy skit, and it had to do with these bumbling terrorists, and I'm just scrapping it. You know, everybody was sort of censoring themselves, and they were very sensitive to what was going on at that moment. And I think that's the first time that people were actually taking into account things that were going on. It was...
Right, because up until then, we were just like, la,
no,
la,
no,
la,
we're
la,
just going to do
la, la.
What we want to do. We're going to write what we're going to write. We're going to say what we're going to say. But it was like, okay, you know what? I need to respect this event. And
yeah,
this
because it was, it was just... Like, there was everybody before and everybody after. That's all I'm going to say. All right, Dennis, when did you know you were going to be an actor?
Oh.
Are your family performers, musicians?
No. Huh. Nobody in my family really was a performer, per se. I think at a very early age, I would see things on TV, of course, movies, and I was fascinated. I mean, my folks would take me to the old Sanders Theater on whatever movie happened to be playing. They didn't have babysitters, so, you know, I was seeing things like Lady Sings the Blues and, you know, For Pete's Sake with... which actually was filmed in the neighborhood with Barbra
really?
Streisand.
Wow. Well, a lot of movies have been filmed in this neighborhood.
Yeah, and I've seen them all.
Dog.
And I remember when they were filming that. They filmed, when I was coming home from school, they were filming The Lords of Flatbush along 8th Avenue between 11th and 12th Street. So I saw Sylvester Stallone. I saw Henry Winkler.
Wow, that's cool. So we're talking about the 70s?
Yeah, this...
Or
yeah,
the
80s? That was 73.
Okay,
that
wow.
That was 73, yeah, because that movie was released in 74. Dog Day Afternoon was
like
also
75 or 74.
No, same.
Really?
Really, within all that, I would say between 73 and 75, all these movies were being filmed.
Wow.
A little bit later then, there was they were filming Ragtime, and
oh,
they
wow.
used the
I remember
interior.
That movie.
Yeah, they used the interior of the armory, and I was about, I guess I was about 14. Maybe 13, 14, and anytime I saw a film crew, I was out there. I was like, you know, yeah, I'm hanging around. And I was standing in front of the armory, and I just remember the crew was there, and they already knew me, you know, and they're like, hi, how you doing? I'm like, yeah, I'm just hanging around. And I see this limo pull up, and my dad just happened to, for whatever reason, he was off. I guess it was summer, so maybe he was on vacation. And he knew where I was, so he came walking over, and he was standing with me, and he's like, so what are you waiting? I'm like, I'm just watching them film. And all of a sudden, I see this limo pull up, and then I see this large man come out, and he's already in period makeup. You know, he's got the big ambassador's mustache on.
Oh, wow.
Just the type that curl up into your sideburn. And, you know, he walked out, and he had a helper, and he's like, good morning, gentlemen. You know, and he had his outfit from the turn of the century, and it's so hot out. And he's walking up to the door to go in, and I realized that was Jimmy Cagney.
Really?
And
oh,
I was like,
my God.
I was standing there, and when he said that, my dad was like, who was that? And he was the guy that always, he was the one that taught me about actors and artists and all of this stuff. And I was like standing there like,
So you were like a kid, like.
I'd say I was about 12.
12, okay.
At that moment in time.
See, you knew who Jimmy Cagney
yes,
was.
Yes, I was.
And
I
you
did.
Were 12. Because when we were kids, they would run all these
yes.
wonderful old movies,
and
some of them in black and white, like the Million Dollar Movie on
yep.
Channel 9 and Channel 11.
Yep. Right.
Before there was cable, before
no
there was
TCM.
Internet.
Yep.
No TCM.
Yep.
They would just.
And it was the luck of the draw, too.
Yep, yep,
you know,
yep.
Whatever you
but,
saw.
But you know, in those days, old movies became kind of in vogue because all these old actors. Or older actors would wind up on the talk shows because
yes.
oh
Johnny
you know
Carson
let's talk to Betty Davis, let's talk to Deborah Kerr because you know their movies are on and people want to know what they're up to.
Yeah,
you know now it's you know our kids, you know we take them to see some of these old movies. We took them to see Casablanca at Brooklyn mm-hmm. Bridge Park. You know we want to introduce them to. You know, some of the older movies that they wouldn't put on themselves.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great thing because I think a lot of that knowledge is just being lost because I don't know if it's because a lot of young people aren't interested or because they're not exposed to it. I mean, I think kids, as a rule, are not really interested, but we were exposed to it so much we became interested.
Right, we only had 7 channels.
Yeah. And that's the.
Exactly. And Channel 13.
And Channel 13.
There's almost too much for them.
Yeah.
To watch
yeah. Look,
and
when
choose from.
But, you know, as kids, when it was a big deal when these movies came on TV,
yes.
right?
And we saw them anyway, whether we were ready for them or not.
That's right.
Yeah, I remember that they took us to see a workshop production of Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat
oh.
with William Catt.
Wow.
And it's one of the first, theater moments I remember.
My first Broadway show, I was in fourth grade. And it was The Wiz with Stephanie Mills.
I remember The Wiz.
And
oh
I think after that point in school, we would go see one Broadway show a year.
That's what happened in public school in New York City.
Yeah.
Yes, we would go see.
I mean, what a luxury, really. And it was, you know, discounted price, whatever. And then the second show that we saw the year after was Timbuktu with Eartha Kitt and Melba Moore.
Eartha Kitt! Oh,
yes.
So that was a treat, and it was a real treat to see her. But could you imagine being a kid and you're like, hey, that's Catwoman. Yeah. And I get to see it. And it was, you just fall in love with the magic. Because, you know, then they had the TKTS booth. We would go every so often and get, half price tickets. We saw a Chorus Line. We saw Evita. That's how long ago this was. And I think we saw My One and Only with Tommy Tune and Twiggy.
Great musical.
But you know, you could do that because it would wind up, a $40 ticket would wind up costing us, you know, $20. And that was somewhat affordable, you know. Now it's like a half price ticket is still, you know, $60
at least.
So many great shows that you guys have been reminiscing about and going to see as young people. Now, when you guys were in college as theater majors and you met and you fell in love and you got married, how did your careers take off? I mean, like, what was it like for you two to be both young, Latino, and artistic at a time in New York when being Latino and artistic weren't necessarily two things that most people would think would go together?
After college, I got involved with a few Latino theater companies, and I kind of...
Puerto Rican traveling theater?
No, you know what? No, I actually, it was Latea.
Latea was actually the first
theater in Manhattan. My first couple of things I did was right here in Park Slope in Gallery Players. So I started with Gallery Players, and then Gallery Players gave me a couple of musicals. Then I kind of tripped into Latea.
Which is a legit off-Broadway house.
Yes, which is a legit off-Broadway house, and that is now in Clemente Soto Velez, which at the time was full of squatters. That's what it was. Nobody had any, you know, it was just a bunch of artists who actually took it over. I remember rehearsing in Latea space, and there were squatters who were actually painters, artists, who lived in a room in the back by their space. And we would be rehearsing in the theater space, and sometimes they'd walk out like in their pajamas or, you know, half naked, you know, to go to the bathroom and watch our rehearsal for what we were doing.
And this was on the Lower East Side.
This is on the Lower East Side on Suffolk.
Which at the time was not gentrified yet.
No,
and
I remember sitting dicey.
Yeah.
I remember sitting in a rehearsal for that particular show again, and we were down in the bigger space downstairs, which I don't know who has it now, maybe Flamboyant or whatever, but we were down in the bigger space and we were rehearsing, and all of a sudden we heard pop, 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 pop.
I know what that is.
Yeah. And everybody went, ooh.
Not firecrackers. Yeah,
and they went, rehearsal's over. Okay, everybody, we're going to buddy up and we're heading to the subway. Nobody's leaving here alone. You know, and that's what it was. And within I would say 3 minutes of the four or five pops, you know, you hear the sirens. And we waited till the sirens got closer and closer, and we left.
Yes.
You know, because that's the way it was.
Well, and you didn't want to be mistaken for the people that were doing the pop, pop, popping either.
Exactly.
You know, because that's another thing that you have to think about.
Yeah.
Wild stuff. And then I tripped into Here Theater from there, you know, here, Home for the Contemporary Art and Tiny Mythic.
Mm-hmm.
Merged, moved from East 4th and created Here. And because of that, I tripped into there. You know, I did.
And you've been doing off-Broadway stuff and some Broadway stuff ever since.
Yeah, and then tripped into the New Yorican with her. Before her.
He was in a play that my cousin Janice wrote called Fuchsia. And also, I was working with another playwright, Eugene Rodriguez, and we did some stuff at the New Yorican. And in fact, one of his plays is called La Mariposa, The Butterfly.
I've heard of that one.
He lives in East Harlem, and that's the name of his house. And he took a dilapidated brownstone, and he brought it back to life, and he's been living there ever since.
Yep.
And it's funny because now East Harlem is going through this gentrification.
Oh yeah, it
stuff
has been.
Going.
Yep.
And he's
you
watching
know,
them come
like
in.
He posted a picture of his backyard, and there's like one of those newfangled big box gray buildings, and everything else is a brownstone. It's like, you know, it looks. I'm not crazy about it. The architecture. Give me a good solid brownstone any day. But anyway, we were doing a lot of work at the New Yorican, and his work is always about characters, and his themes are always a New Yorican. That's just what he does. So I fell into that work that way, and then of course, doing Janice's work, also at the New Eureka and Wow Cafe or wherever we can get. Her work is usually about gay and lesbian issues and, of course, the Latino
family. As she was writing this stuff like 15, 18, 20 years ago,
yeah.
when a Latino writer wasn't writing about stuff like that. Or if they were, it wasn't getting produced.
Right, yeah. Right. And, you know, they. I think they have
the
numbers.
Janice was a groundbreaker in a lot of ways. She's won awards and stuff, and it's well-deserved.
You know, it's so funny because in between all of that, before tripping into the New Eureka, and I got introduced to the New Eureka actually through a production that I did, and I actually did wind up performing at BAM, at Brooklyn Academy
Music.
In the space, which is now, I think, their movie theaters. There was an open space there that was kind of flexible to do stuff. And this gentleman, Carlos, I'm trying to remember his last name, but I can't. He was actually a UN delegate to Panama. So he was an Afro-Panamanian. And he wrote this piece with music about what it meant to be like an Afro-Panamanian in Panama and all the class distinctions between skin color and all of that. And it was one of the weirdest kind of best experiences I had, because he did it in a dinner theater style because the space was open in those three in that area. And you know, we had the premiere, and these women and these men came dressed to the nines. I mean, you know, he worked for the UN, so you know, he had all this money to throw away. But it was so funny. They were all kind of dressed up, and you know, it talked to culture, it talked to a lot of things, and every time we said like a truth, they would be talking at us, yelling at us,
wow.
You know, and doing all this stuff. And I was like, oh my God, this is the wildest theater I've ever done, you know?
So it was like participatory?
It wasn't supposed
thing?
To be, but oh. When we would just say things that...
Well, give me an example.
No Latinos, they got to tell you.
They
got to
tell
they gotta
you, and
they were
talking right at us.
They need their stage time.
You know, and I was, of course, the kind of mixed Panamanian, you know, more on the Hispanic side, which they would call me the Colón boy, which Colón for Panamanian meant, you know, that you had better hair and you had lighter skin, you know, not necessarily dark or black. So there was a lot of stuff that went on in this play that, you know, and you would think that these people who were so dressed up to the nines wouldn't be talking at the characters.
So they're breaking the fourth wall.
They were breaking
together.
The fourth wall. It was fun, though. It was a lot of fun. And then through one of the actors there who passed away, his name, I remember, Khalif Brathwaite, because he used to know Rome Neal, who was a big director at the New Eureka.
I've worked
at
Rome Neal.
So I got to know Rome Neal through, because he was doing a piece there, and I went to see it one day. And it was so funny because at that point, me and Allison had lost touch after graduating. But when we got back together a couple of years after that, we realized that we were kind of running around in the same circles, knowing the same people. You know, you know, and the same actors and stuff,
right.
And it's like, oh, it is.
Let
it
me
is.
Ask you a question. Did you ever work with Miriam at the
Puerto Rican? No, I was part of their playwriting unit, which is where I met. I met Franco before when we moved to Park Slope. We formed a little theater company called Stuff of Life, and we put an APB for new plays, and Franco Ambrise put in a play, and I directed this play reading, and Franco was there, and Franco was part of this playwriting group, and he goes, you should come as a director. And basically we would read plays in development, and we'd give our feedback sit at a table and give our feedback. So that's how I got involved with the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater. I never directed there, but I was part of that playwriting unit.
Yeah, and then there were a couple of little pieces that I wound up doing play readings through that at the Puerto Rican traveling.
Yeah, that was just, just like a great connector, because that's how I met Franco. I must have auditioned through backstage for one of his plays, and then he loved me and he wanted to put me in everything, and then that's how I met you, and now we're here.
And here we are. Yeah.
And here we are. Yeah. So how have the trajectories for both of you morphed over the years? Mm. You work in nonprofit now. How did you get into that?
Well, one of my first jobs, I had an internship with Mabu Mines, which was in the East Village, in the PS-122 building. I sort of got into the theater admin and the stage management part of things. And then I decided I really don't want to be a stage manager, because I stage managed for Coney Island, USA. They did, Dick Ziggin wrote a play, farcical about Alice in Wonderland, but it had all these references to to pop culture. And I through Mabu Mines, I kind of got exposed to a different kind of theater, and I was doing things on our own, and this morphed into Stuff of Life theater, which I directed Janice's play, I'll Be Home Para La Navidad, which we did here in Park Slope at the Gallery Players. And it was kismet, because they had a set that was a kitchen and a living room, and that's exactly what we needed. So we rented space from them. We said, we need your set. We'll take it down for you when we're done. And they were like, sure. So that worked. So it had good production values. Dennis was in it. We had just gotten married, and I produced another play that I wrote called Scarlet Fever. We did it at
St. Anne's
when it was really in St. Anne's
to the warehouse.
But it was about the news media, and it was about the treatment of this woman and how unfair it was.
Yeah.
The culture wars as well. You know, and how they just, a woman is damned if she. Yeah. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. And the treatment of Hester Prynne, that, you know, in the 1600s, it still would happen today, and this is how it would unfold.
And your current job is as an arts administrator for another theater.
Right, Repertorio Español, and I've been there, it will be 20 years.
Ideal.
50th anniversary as a not-for-profit, off-Broadway, Spanish-language theater company.
Is it one of the oldest?
One of the oldest. Mm-hmm. It's a true repertory company in that we have about 12 to 15 different plays that run throughout a season. And they run in rep. You know, every weekend it's a different schedule. You know, I'm the special projects manager, so we had a playwriting competition. So I...
Yeah, Nuestras Voces.
Nuestras Voces. I think you've been a judge for me.
Yes.
A couple times.
And we know a few people who have won. I think Jenny Elsa Saldana is one of them.
Right.
The Chronicles of BC Jenny, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, she was a finalist, runner-up. A lot of great plays, a lot of great ideas. Through that, I'm working with a lot of playwrights, putting on play reading festivals. And also, if we're lucky, we get... funded to do a Van Leer Director's Fellowship, and I also put that together. And, you know, the playwriting competition and the Director's Fellowship, we're looking for to encourage Latino artists, right? Because who else is doing that? You know, our audience are Latin Americans, they're from Spain, they're from the Caribbean, and they're also second and third generation Hispanics.
Yes.
Through the playwriting competition, yes, a lot. Two-thirds of the plays are going to come in English. But our caveat is the plays have to be about Latinos and themes and subject matter that's of interest to the Latino, Hispanic, or should I say Latinx community.
So briefly, how would you say that the subject matter of the plays has changed over the last 20 years?
I think we get a lot of plays that sometimes you go, well, this is it really a Latino play or is it a very universal play? But I have to say in the last, 8-10 years, a majority of the plays that come in have to do with Mexican American crossing over, so immigration.
The new diaspora. Well, not new, but like the current one.
Well, current subject matter. But I have to say that there's plays about Puerto Ricans. There's plays about Guatemalans. There's lots of different variety. But I think, we've gotten a lot of plays about Frida Kahlo. We got a great play about Che Guevara that was a finalist. So, there's a lot of different subject matters that they're touching.
Yeah, I mean, Wild in Wichita.
Wild in Wichita.
Which is about two aging, Hispanic people, one Mexican gentleman and a Puerto Rican woman who happened to be in an old age home in
Wichita,
Kansas. And all their, all the things that they thought were their differences and how many things they kind of find that they have similar and that they can relate to. And their two children, which I happen to play the son of the Puerto Rican woman, and all of those things that they find that they can actually, have a relationship and fall in love. That was very different. And it was a cute play.
Great scene in there where they're talking about, Mexican music is better than Puerto Rican music,
yeah,
and Mexican
that's
food
hysterical.
Is better than Puerto Rican food. Yeah. And no, it's not. And they go back and forth. So even, yes, they're both Latinos, but they are their differences. The diversity.
The diversity. And I mean, for me, the last few years, for whatever reason, I tripped into another neighborhood. I've worked a lot in Inwood because there's a big artistic community up in Inwood in Upper Manhattan. And I started doing one play called Ache, which is, an interesting play, which then wound up being a finalist later. But they did a full production, and it was about these two brothers who happened to be twins, but one was white, one was black, and they were separated at birth. One needs to have like a kidney transplant, and the other one is the one who has the kidney. But it was, it's that whole thing, and one happens to be gay, and the other one is, isn't. He's in, a hetero relationship. So that was like a really interesting play to do up there, and we happened to do it in what was a student chapel, a church. So to top that all off, we did it in a what would be a consecrated space.
Wow, that sounds great. So
it was awesome.
So Dennis, briefly, how would you say your career has morphed and changed over the last couple of decades?
Like I said, I started with these groups and kind of tripped into all of these different things, like Latea, going into the Puerto Rican Traveling Theater playwriting group, working at Here Theater, actually inaugurating Here Theater, doing Shakespeare, and then kind of took a lull for a while, and all of a sudden I find myself doing more Shakespeare again. And then I'm now currently a company member of Magis Theater Company. We just did a production at La Mama. So I found my way back to the East Village, performing in that fantastic space. And what we wound up doing was the Spanish Golden Age play, Life is a Dream, which was actually written twice. The gentleman took it. He wrote it in 1635, which is the version everybody else knows and loves
and
reads in Spanish. And then he wrote it again, kind of like Sophocles in 1677, but he made it into an allegory because he was a priest at that point. And he was forced to be the court playwright, even though he was like, I don't want to do this. And it's like, well, you got to do this. So the first act was the 1635, full out. We had to edit here and there to be able to make it into 3 hours. And then the next show was, the 1677, which had music. Calderon was also the father of the zarzuela, which is the Spanish operetta. Liz Suedos, before she passed away, had written music for it.
Wow. So between the two of you, there's a shared history and basically a legacy of Latino theater in New York City over a generation. Now, as a married couple with three gorgeous children, how is your legacy being transferred to the next generation? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, we take them to see a lot of theater.
Yeah, we do. Even the things I'm not doing.
Yes. Not in- Luckily, he's been in a lot of places.
I've been in a lot of places, yes.
That they can see.
Yes.
You know.
Say the ages of your children so we have a context.
Okay, Jessica is 17, Stephen is 15, and Amanda is 13. Yeah. So we try to expose them, whether it's film, theater, to the arts, like it or not, here it comes. Jessica, our oldest, is a vocal major at LaGuardia High School.
Like, fame!
Yes.
Fame. And this is what she wants to study in college. So she wants to major in music and music education. And Amanda is in middle school, and she is studying the cello.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
There's going to be another generation of Vargas artists, LTD.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
I mean, to me, this is so incredible because I think this is exactly the kind of story that people need to hear, that we have a Latino family that are working artists, that are in the arts, whose life is in the arts, and that the legacy is being passed to the next generation. And it shows that it can be done in New York City.
Yeah.
That is amazing. And in Brooklyn, the Park Slope love story.
Yeah, yes. You know, one of the things we love about this neighborhood actually is, you know, when they were little, we used to walk them to the puppet show, to the puppet theater here on
Sixth Avenue.
Mm-hmm. And we'd go up to the band shell. And I remember one of our favorite things is the Alloy Orchestra. They create with three musicians the background music to silent films, and they did Metropolis, and we've seen it like three times already.
About three
and your
times.
Children have also
and
Metropolis?
Yes. Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because I was at SVA before I saw it, because at Theater 80 used to show all those movies.
Yeah.
Right.
But to be exposed to that even at a young
and
age,
you know,
that's
incredible. At the end that you know, mm-hmm. nobody's minding the machines and the water is flowing down, and I remember Stephen, he was kind of young, and he goes,
like,
oh,
fuck.
There goes the neighborhood. and then another time.
About six.
On that note, we started this journey in Park Slope, and we're going to end it in Park Slope.
Yeah.
Dennis, your entire life has been in Park Slope, which has seen, speaking of there goes the neighborhood, it has seen change and change and change and change again.
Yeah.
Why don't you give us just a tiny bit of an inkling of what it was like to grow up in a neighborhood that has gone from one polarized extreme to another in your lifetime?
Yeah, you know, growing up, you know, we lived all around Park Slope, my parents. By the time I was seven, we were already living at 12th Street between 8th and the Park. It was a neighborhood. There were a lot of conflicts. There were fights. There were all sorts of stuff, criminality, whatever you want to think about, or, you know, in terms of gritty New York, it was happening in Park Slope, whether it was the House of Ill Repute, the whorehouse, two houses down, that had a bunch of women living there, and, you know, their pimp coming over and picking them up. His name is Cody. He had a blue Cadillac, 1956, white interior. Used to come up every Friday night, pick up his girls, and they would leave. You know, I remember the garbage strike, people burning garbage in the middle of the street, you know, and then eventually seeing that change, and even my parents seeing that change. And at one point they were going to leave the city. They thought, oh, all right. But then they saw the change and they said, well, maybe we're not going to go anywhere. They were going to stay right here. And they did, you know, and slowly things started to change and morph. More of the artists moved in, such as yourself.
I came to this neighborhood as a recent art school graduate.
Yeah.
It was the only place that wasn't the Bronx
that
I could afford.
And I remember, you know, we had neighbors. It was a guy.
And that was in the 80s.
That was in the 80s.
That was in the 80s. And I came
exactly.
to this neighborhood as an artist and living amongst other Puerto Ricans, but I was there as an artist, which
as
is like
artist.
A different
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So I kind of almost feel like the gentrification, I was like the first wave of it, and I didn't even know it at the time.
And I remember, you know, we had neighbors that bought, like, the houses around us. Yeah, they bought houses around us. And I remember one of our first neighbors when, I mean, like I said, I was always interested in acting. And we had a next-door neighbor who, there was the first co-op in the neighborhood. And he bought a unit in the building next door. His name was Jimmy Young. I was in maybe junior or senior in high school, and he was already performing. He was in the chorus line. He was in the chorus and the chorus line. He went from that to Me and My Girl, and he was the understudy for Jim Dale. And I got to see him perform, actually. And it was funny. He was the first professional actor to kind of, my parents told him, oh, he's interested in acting, will you talk to him? And he was really nice, and he invited me over, and he showed me his resume, his 8x10, and all of this stuff that I didn't know about. He taught me about backstage and all of this. And he's like, you know, he was in the Tap Dance Kid. That was the other show that he was doing at that time. And then after that, he got Me and My Girl, and I'll never forget, I said, oh, anytime you get called in to replace him, let me know. And, you know, this is before cell phones, and I happened to be home, and he called me like a nutcase and said, I'm coming on tonight, you're gonna have house seats, you know. So I ran over to see him at the the Marriott Marquis theater. And I had house seats, and I was watching. That was another Broadway experience, seeing somebody you actually knew, you know,
and
performing.
From your neighborhood.
Yeah, and it's so funny because one of the things that I remember going into his house was that he still had the top hat from the chorus line, and he had it up on his hat tree, and it was like, it had a place of honor up top, and you knew immediately what
right.
it was.
Wasn't one of your neighbors won an Oscar for a film short?
Oh, yeah, no, he was my parents' tenant. His name was Jim Brown, and it was called The Pilgrim, and I got to hold an Oscar.
That is...
He won, wow. I forgot what year it was, but it was called The Pilgrim. It was a short film.
So now that we have established Park Slope, Brooklyn is not only the most cultured neighborhood,
yes,
with theater and artistic provenance,
yes,
I want to ask you one last question, both of you, before we end our little time together. Most of the people that... No, not all, but I've interviewed mostly people that either don't have children or their children are quite small, and your kids are teens and, you know, almost grown. So this is a question I've been asking everybody. What advice would you give to the child sitting in her bedroom, in her top floor tenement walk-up, or in her little suburban house, or in her comfortable little brownstone, or anywhere in the world that this child wants to be an artist but is not knowing how to find their way to it? What advice would you give them?
Well, you know what? When I started Fordham, I knew I had a passion for it. So follow your passion.
Yeah.
And actually...
Have passion, yes.
Have passion. Really want to do it. Because it's work. Everyone thinks, oh, theater major, you're not doing much. Wrong.
No, the hardest work is being on a friggin' film set for 14 hours.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Yeah,
and doing the reading and the research and
yeah.
stuff
that you need to do in the
yeah.
back, the,
yeah.
the historical.
Or the doing nothing for 6 hours and then ding, showtime, you got to do
yeah.
it. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
you got to be on.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Always.
It's a lot of digging.
Yeah.
I follow your passion. And, like, you know, you're only going to get what you put in.
Do you have anything to add, Dennis?
I would say, yeah, I would definitely agree, you know, when it comes to stuff like auditioning, if you're into that, if you want to be a performer, you know, don't let the nerves get you. You know, perfection isn't necessarily what a lot of people are looking for, directors are looking for. They're looking for passion. They're looking for a feeling, you know, that, you know, you really love what you're going to do or what you are doing. So it's not so much perfection as it should be, you know, as it is passion.
I think passion is the perfect word to leave this interview. Passion in Park. This is the Passion in Park Slope episode. Thank you, Dennis and Allison, Esther Vargas, for being on Fish Out of Agua.
Thank you.
Woohoo!
Sé que aún me queda una oportunidad. Sé que aún no es tarde para recapacitar. Sé que nuestro amor es verdadero. Con los años que me quedan por vivir, demostraré cuánto te quiero. Con los años que me quedan, yo viviré por darte amor, borrando cada dolor con besos llenos de pasión, como te amé por vez primera. Con los años que me quedan, te haré olvidar cualquier error. No quise herirte, mi amor. Sabes que eres mi adoración y lo serás mi vida entera. No puedo imaginar vivir sin ti. No quiero recordar cómo te perdí. Quizás fue inmadurez de mi parte. No te supe querer. Te aseguro que los años que me quedan, los voy a dedicar a ti, a hacerte tan feliz que te enamores más de mí. Yo te amaré hasta que muera. ¿Cómo comprobar que no soy quien fui? Tiempo te dirá si tienes fe en mí, que como yo te amé, más nadie te podrá amar jamás. Dime que no es el final. Sé que aún me queda una oportunidad. Sé que aún no es tarde para recapacitar. Sé que nuestro amor es verdadero. Ay, con los años que me quedan por vivir, demostraré cuánto te quiero. Sé que nuestro amor es verdadero y con los años que me quedan por vivir, demostraré cuánto te quiero. Cuánto te quiero.
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was Gloria Estefan with Con los años que me quedan, which means with the years that I have left or the years that remain, from her 1993 Mi Tierra album. And it's actually the song from Dennis and Allison's wedding, which was in the 90s. I don't know. I forgot what year. Well, yeah, we played their wedding song. All right, Dennis and Allie, woo! Hey, kids, and that's our show. I have an announcement to make first. On next Monday, November 20th, Radio Free Brooklyn and the Footlight Bar are combining to sponsor the Fish Out of Agua Story Show. Monday, November 20th at 7 o'clock p.m., hosted by me and featuring stories from some of our best guest artists from the past season. Well, there aren't even any seasons anymore. It's just one long season on Radio Free Brooklyn. Yes, Monday, November 20th at the Footlight Bar, 465 Seneca Avenue in Ridgewood, just a short walk from the DeKalb stop on the L train. Tickets are just $5. There'll be trivia, prizes, some special surprises. It starts at 7, and hey, you can hang out for the New York City Talent Show immediately following. And stay tuned for Brooklyn Bandstand next, and we are going to close with the last of the Astor Vargas picks. And you better listen up. It's going to remind you a little bit of a season that's gone past, and it's from Chicago, Saturday in the Park, from their Chicago 5 album in 1973. See yous next week! Woo-hoo!
Such a long time.